You are Locked On Marlins, your daily podcast on the Miami Marlins. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
This is the Locked On Marlins podcast, your go-to podcast for all things Miami Marlins. As always, I'm your host, Arm Layton. I'm the founder of JustBaseball.com, as well as a longtime Marlins writer. And in today's episode, we have a few different storylines I wanted to talk about. There's a few things that are interesting down the line here, and when you have a team that's not very competitive, you're going to have to look for things to make it worth watching. And I think there are plenty of things worth watching right now, so I want to highlight some of those. That includes the Rookie of the Year race, which I'll be honest, I will be very honest and put myself on the spot here. I definitely was putting Trevor Rogers out of the race, and it wasn't a race anymore because Rogers is obviously the runner-up, even if he didn't pitch another ball game after he missed that extended time. But Jonathan India, he's been so good, and I don't want to take anything away from India as a leadoff hitter for one of the better offenses in baseball and a guy who did not really benefit that much compared to most of his teammates from playing at Great American Ballpark. There's a lot of reasons to like Jonathan India, especially with his on-base percentage flirting around 400 for so much of the year. The defense could use some work, and I could do a whole breakdown on India, but that's not why you're listening to the podcast. But what I will say about India is that he has faded a little bit, as have the Reds, but India has been hitting in the low 200s over his last 30 games. That on-base percentage not as high. We have to mention the defense as a reason to maybe hurt his Rookie of the Year case a little bit, not much, because he has still been an offensive force for a good team over a macro scale. But now Trevor Rogers, you look at him, he has been consistent all year long. And yes, he missed that time, and it was really unfortunate given that he had a lot of family issues going on, and that's way more important. But he's come back and just shown his perseverance and been able to, after a rocky start and a half, has been really good since. His velo was a bit down. I had some people asking me whether there should be some concern with that velo being down. I think Craig Mish had even said maybe even shut him down for the season. It seemed like it was more just him getting back into shape and back into the swing of things. He missed more time than I think some people realized. As we saw him work back up after his second outing and then really just built those innings back up, got back into shape, that dead arm kind of went away, and we saw a fantastic start in his last outing. And now his numbers over the course of the season, 24 starts, which he's probably going to get two more starts before the season is over. He'll have 26 starts under his belt. He'll have close to 140 innings, maybe a little bit more than that, depending on how these two outings go. He was an all-star this year. He has averaged nearly 11 strikeouts per nine innings, a 1.1 whip, a 2.61 FIP, which is fielding independent pitching, an important metric to kind of be able to gauge how legitimate an ERA is. Well, a 2.61 FIP and a 2.67 ERA says it's pretty legitimate. Rogers has not only been the best rookie starter, he has been one of the better starters in baseball this year, just point blank period. Those numbers you would take in the front of almost any singular rotation in baseball. There's not that many pitchers that are doing better than Trevor Rogers has over the course of the season. Because of the time that he missed, Rogers is technically not qualified for the league leaders in ERA, but if we qualify him, because I think he's just a few innings short of that designation, he would be in the top six, I believe. It would actually be top five in all of Major League Baseball. Max Scherzer at 2.28 ERA. You've got Corbin Burns at 2.34. Brandon Woodruff at 2.52, which, by the way, is so unfair what Milwaukee's got going on over there with their pitching, and I'm going to talk about that in a second as well. Walker Buehler at a 2.58 ERA, and then Robbie Ray is fifth at 2.72. So that's where we would see Trevor Rogers slot in. Top five in Major League Baseball in ERA. Scherzer's going to win the Cy Young in the NL, most likely. That's my pick. On the AL side, it's either going to be Robbie Ray or Garrett Cole, most likely, and those are the only two other guys that are in that vicinity. So you're looking at two Cy Young candidates, I guess, right in that same vicinity. He's probably going to have a better ERA at the end of the season than the AL Cy Young Award winner, and will be only trailing the NL Cy Young Award winner and the runner-up in Corbin Burns. It's going to be Scherzer or Burns, and then Woodruff, who will get quite quite a few votes there as well. So what it looks like now is that you have one of the most dominant pitchers, young pitchers in baseball, that we're comparing to a hitter who has played every single day. And that's kind of the problem. I was talking about this with Jeff Conine on our podcast Outside the Box with Jeff Conine, and he is not a huge fan, obviously, because he's a position player. He's not a huge fan of MVP awards going to pitchers. And when you have a Rookie of the Year award, obviously he's going to lean towards a position player. But what is true of that, no matter where you stand, is that is very hard to compare a guy that plays every single day to a guy who plays every fifth day, but the fate of the game essentially lays in his hand. So it's really difficult to pit these guys against each other, and it's one of those things that we have to do quite often. The realistic thing is that if Jonathan India continues to fade here over the last couple weeks, the Reds fade, and India's numbers start looking a little bit more pedestrian, he doesn't hit a ton of home runs, his real boost was the high on base percentage and a lot of the clutch factor and just what he's been able to do to set the tone for a very good offense. But now that that offense has faded, now that that team has faded, and now that he is slowing down, I think we've got to reevaluate this thing. And obviously, if Rodgers comes out and has a rocky two starts, then you'll probably just lean towards the guy that's done it over the course of the whole year. But if Rodgers comes out here and gives us two quality starts of six innings, maybe seven, and racks up 8 to 10 Ks like we've seen him do so many times this year, we've really got to give him some serious consideration. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Regardless, what a year for Trevor Rodgers, not only for what he's done when he's on the field, but to come back after the adversity that he dealt with the loss in his family, with the illness in his family, and to just continue to perform on a team that has not performed as a whole is really admirable. And I hope the Marlins continue to piece it together, and we'll see how things look this coming offseason. But that's why I wanted to talk about the Brewers, because I really feel like the Brewers are a good rough mold of what the Marlins can hope to achieve. The Brewers have a pitching rotation that is just utterly absurd. It's not fair. And I'm sure you can look at the Brewers team and say, yeah, but where are the Marlins going to get their Yelich? But when they already had him, I know, which makes it sting even more. But Yelich is not the MVP guy right now, and he hasn't been over the last year and a half. And the Brewers have been great despite that. They have been one of the best teams in baseball despite not having that MVP caliber type of guy in their offense. That's got to be encouraging for the Marlins. And that's something that I've talked about with a few different big leaguers, that what is it that stands out to you in a team? Like, what is one quality that you think is really important for a team to have success in the postseason? None of them said juggernaut offense, even though, of course, anybody's taking a juggernaut offense in 2 seconds. What they've all said is three stud pitchers. You have three stud pitchers in a 7-game series, you are in the driver's seat. The Brewers went out and they got Willy Adames, and that was a big game changer for them. I mean, the guy's got nearly a 900 OPS and is playing the shortstop position. Colton Wong was a great acquisition for them as well. But these are the types of moves that the Marlins can make. The Marlins can go trade for even a, I know Willy Adames was a cheaper target because he wasn't performing to the level he is now, but the Marlins have the prospect capital to go get a player that is of Willy Adames' caliber right now, of his Brewers' caliber. So you can go get that middle infielder quality of player. I'm not saying they need to do that because Miggy Rowe's vesting option. You could go do that in center field. That could be your Willy Adames type of acquisition. Of course, I would do anything for Cedric Mullins, who's going to finish the year probably with a 30-30 season and is probably one of my favorite players now in the game, just seeing what he's been able to do. Of course, a Brian Reynolds would be fantastic, but now those guys are encroaching on the superstar threshold. I don't know if they're attainable. Maybe a Ketel Marte, he's also a superstar, but the Diamondbacks, they have no use of keeping him at this point. We can rehash all of the targets. The larger point is here is you go get that centerpiece of your offense, that centerpiece of a young, energetic spark plug that you can rely on to give you consistent production. It's something that every team needs, quite obviously, and the Marlins are lacking that to a degree, or to a large degree. They also went, the Brewers did, and got their free agent signing, Avisail Garcia, who is a perfect example of someone that the Marlins could go target. That was somebody that we had floated as maybe a target for the Marlins last offseason, a little bit too pricey. Brewers go and get him, and he's been fantastic this year. 29 homers. I know that it's in Milwaukee, so I think if he was in Miami, he'd be probably closer to the low 20s. Still a great year, 841 OPS. And for what the Marlins are looking to do this offseason, that's a guy that they would be willing to pay in that range, I guess would be the word to describe. Mark Canha could be that guy for the Marlins this coming year. What the Brewers did, I think, is a really, really good outline and mold. They had the present pitching. They had Brandon Woodruff. They knew what they had in Corbin Burns. They were excited about Freddie Peralta. Those were the guys that they were pumped about. Here's the difference between the Marlins and the Brewers beyond the lineup acquisitions, because I think the Marlins can go make those lineup acquisitions, whether they want to spend a ton of money or not. You can piece together some bats in this offseason with the prospect capital that you have and a little bit of money that we know that they're going to spend. I don't know how much they're going to spend, but they're going to spend a little bit of money. I mean, that's what the perception is. If they don't, then who knows what the hell these guys are trying to do at that point if they're not spending any money at all. I'm not saying it has to be $200 million for Trevor Story or $250 million for Carlos Correa, who is undoubtedly out of their price range now. I know that was somebody that was attached to the Marlins early in the year. Correa has been so fantastic. He's my number one free agent coming into this offseason. Don't think that's going to be a target for the Marlins. You could float an Anthony Rizzo type, but I think Lewin Diaz has shown enough that the Marlins need to figure out what they're going to do with Jesus Aguilar and Garrett Cooper and all of that. And that's an entirely different episode in itself. The big difference between the Brewers and the Marlins beyond the bats is the bullpen. The Marlins, you're not going to find a Josh Hader. That's okay. You don't need to try to find a Josh Hader. You don't need to try to find a Devin Williams. You just need to find some reliable back end arms that you can count on, that you know will not have a roller coaster of a season, and you're going to hold your breath every time they go out there, and you're going to have to decide who your closer is every single week. That won't fly. And that's the beautiful thing that the Brewers have here, is they know the ninth inning is nailed down. Even if there's a rare occasion where Josh Hader blows it up, you know that the next time he comes out there, he's probably going to close it out. You have confidence in your setup man. You have confidence in basically the last three innings. The bridge to there is pretty simple. It's five to six innings from their starters. Obviously, if every once in a while, Corbin Burns will go way deeper than that. Same with Woodruff and Peralta. But they know that if they get six innings out of their starter, they're in good shape. They just need a few runs. And Brad Boxberger, Devin Williams, Hunter Strickland, and Josh Hader will bridge that gap to the promised land. The Marlins bullpen is where I'm more worried. I'm not too concerned about the rotation, obviously, as Sandy Alcantara is starting to look like that Corbin Burns-esque player. In the second half, Sandy Alcantara has been as good as any pitcher in baseball. As I talked about in some previous episodes, his velo is higher than ever. It continues to rise. DeGrom-esque continues to rise. His command is better than ever. His slider is better than ever. It just goes on and on and on. He's turned into a frontline pitcher, and there was just a piece by Devin Fink in Fangraphs talking about how he's becoming one of the best pitchers in the game right now. So you have that clear-cut ace. You have Pablo Lopez, a clear-cut middle-of-the-rotation or potential number two type of guy when he's healthy. You have the prospects, the exciting guys that one of several could slot in and be a stud if they continue to work it out. I really like what we saw from Edward Cabrera in his last outing. I thought that the stuff was much better. I thought that he was mixing it up better, getting a lot more swings and misses, and I think he's going to come out and look much better later today and continue to build off of that. You can't look at the stat lines as much, even though that is what matters at the end of the day. I think you got to look at how his stuff is playing, how the hitters are reacting, and the command overall, and all of that looked a lot better over his last outing and a half. That's another encouraging aspect. Max Meyer, if the Marlins don't trade him, he should be in the rotation next year. There's a lot of exciting pieces that the Marlins have in a rotation that I expect to be one of the best in baseball if everybody is healthy and Sixto Sanchez comes back and they have all of their guys going for them. Trevor Rogers is going to continue to get better and better. You could argue that Rogers and Sandy Alcantara will be as good of a 1-2 punch as you can find in baseball outside of the, Max Scherzer may not stay with the Dodgers, but Walker Buehler and Urias, Woodruff and Burns. There's not very many other better 1-2 punches as these guys continue to get better, because Sandy Alcantara is 26 years old. Trevor Rogers isn't even that. So they have youth on their side. They're continuing to get better. Rogers has improved in almost every regard this season from last year. And same story with Sandy every single year. So it's one of those things that I'm not worried about the rotation. I don't think anybody on earth is worried about the Marlins rotation. How do they piece together the bullpen? How do they piece together that lineup? I think the lineup, they're going to find a way to do that through trades and through a free agent signing or two. The bullpen, you really just got to go out, and I think that's where you really spend the money. Go spend for Raisel Iglesias, go spend for some of those high-end relievers. I know it's not ideal, especially with the volatility of the position, but at least go get one anchor in the back, and Raisel Iglesias would be the perfect guy for them, I think, to anchor the back of it. But that is the Brewers' mold, is what they, I think, should try to follow, and is something that I think is an attainable mold for them as we head into this offseason. I wanted to talk about some of the youngsters and how they've been swinging it in their big league debuts and just how they've been so far this season. That's Brian De La Cruz. How about the incredible Nick Fortes? You also have Lewin Diaz, Jesus Sanchez. It has been really fun to watch these guys swing it and swing it well as of late. A lot of encouraging aspects there. Also, Peyton Burdick, I believe, set the minor league record for the Marlins in walks, which is great. I always say no two strikeout rates are the same. It's more about the K to BB rate, in my opinion. And if you can offset a lot of those Ks with walks, as Peyton Burdick does, there is a really good chance, and I think it improves his chances of becoming a good enough big league bat, and then the tools across the board really just get you excited from there. Brian De La Cruz, plenty to talk about there, so looking forward to getting to that in just a moment. Before I get there, a reminder that this episode is brought to you in part by Freshly. Dinner time can be chaotic, but with Freshly, it's easy. Their chefs take care of your meals a few nights a week and take the pressure off of you. We're all trying to get in shape and eat right, and Freshly can help. Their delicious meals are designed by nutritionists and cooked by chefs, making it easier to eat better. Grocery shopping and cooking can be a pain, especially right now, and with Freshly, you don't have to. Your meals arrive fresh, cooked, and ready to eat every single week. You can keep them in your fridge, stocked, and skip the trip to the store. Ordering is easy. All you have to do is visit Freshly.com and choose from over 30 delicious, satisfying, better-for-you meals like steak peppercorn, sausage baked penne, or their chicken pesto bowl. Freshly can fit your lifestyle with a variety of plans and meals to pick up from that work for your dietary needs, preferences, tastes, and family size. And now our listeners can try Freshly for just $6.16 per meal. Stop searching the internet for healthy food near me every single night and start living life Freshly. Right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to Freshly.com/lockedon. That's $40 off your first two orders when you go to Freshly.com/lockedon. Stop stressing about dinner. Go to Freshly.com/lockedon for $40 off your first two orders. Also brought to you in part by Wealthfront. Day trading can be extremely difficult. In fact, decades of data show that investors who trade individual stocks underperform the market every year. In fact, only 1% of day traders beat the market. The odds are not in your favor if you're doing this alone. Team up with Wealthfront instead. Wealthfront can create a portfolio of globally diversified low-cost index funds personalized just for you in minutes. No manual trades, no picking stocks, no watching the stock market every single day. They automatically handle all the investing based on preferences you control. Wealthfront can even help you lower the taxes you pay as you invest. For the average client, their tax loss harvesting can more than cover the low annual 0.25% advisory fee. Best of all, it's all automatic. Wealthfront is trusted with over $20 billion of assets, and you can get your first $5,000 managed for free by going to Wealthfront.com/LockedOnMLB. That's Wealthfront.com/LockedOnMLB to get your first $5,000 managed for free. Go to Wealthfront.com/LockedOnMLB to get started today. So let's talk a little bit about this Brian De La Cruz mania that we have seen so far this season. And what I want to say about De La Cruz is, obviously, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while now and you've been listening for the duration of the season, one of the craziest things I've ever done in my entire life was predicting the Yimi Garcia for Brian De La Cruz trade exactly, which I don't know how that happened. I don't think I'll ever top that, which kind of sucks at 24 years old. I don't know if I'll ever be able to do something cooler than that. But if you missed it, basically, I was going over trade candidates, trade targets for the Marlins, and just surveying all of the prospects that I thought could be good targets that are close to the big leagues and teams that were good matches in terms of what the Marlins had to offer. And I looked at the Astros. I'm like, they don't have a ton of prospect capital. They're not going to go get Craig Kimbrell, like a lot of people are saying. I don't think they're going to make any of these massive moves, but they could go get a Yimi Garcia and not give up much, like a Brian De La Cruz. And I watched a lot of his ABs to see if that was a target I liked for the Marlins. And I was really impressed with what I had seen from De La Cruz in AAA. And I thought, you know what? This guy profiles a bit as a fourth outfielder, as we've heard a lot of people say. There's no doubt about that. But when I was watching him, I'm like, 24 years old, he's got tools, he's got above average raw power, he plays good defense, he's an above average runner. There's something here where if it all clicks for him, he could good. He might just be a legitimate outfielder, a legitimate above average outfielder in the big leagues and in center field. So the Marlins, it's worth it. If you can trade a reliever and take a flyer on this guy, I like his floor. He's a high floor guy that even if it doesn't work out, he's going to be a really good fourth outfielder with control for the Marlins. So why not? He's an upgrade over some of the other fourth outfield options that the Marlins have. Go make that move. And it's been way better than I thought it would be. And that's the crazy thing is I think I was higher on him than most. And he has exceeded my expectations by a good margin. He's walking 9% of the time. He's only striking out 24% of the time. 131 WRC plus. And honestly, the BABIP, the batting average on balls in play, not as ridiculously high as I thought it would be. He's always been a high BABIP guy because he's an above average runner. He hits the ball hard and it's at 398 for him. I'm expecting that to normalize a little bit more towards the 350, 360 range, which would mean his average goes more towards the 270, 280 range. But with how much he's walking, with a 9% walk rate, which I wasn't expecting from him, and it's only gotten better and better from him in terms of the patience at the plate, which is super encouraging. He was expanding the zone a little bit early on when he first got called up, which is natural, right? He was just excited. He wanted to make an impact. He was trying to do a little bit too much. And since then, has really toned things down and has looked phenomenal at the plate, especially with the sliders. He was trying to go get the sliders quite often, was out and around baseballs, was just going to get it. There's no other way to describe it. Since then, I've seen him take a lot of sliders. I've seen him take a lot of tough pitches and even check swings that he starts to get going and is able to shut it down early enough to lay off those pitches that he was swinging at before. And that is the most encouraging thing is anybody can come out hot right at the beginning of their big league debut. And even though that's exciting, guys come out hot all the time and then hit a freaking wall as the league figures you out and figures out how to pitch to you. And also just coming back to earth a little bit. With De La Cruz, he came out as hot as can be, but he's been better as the season has endured in a lot of ways, especially with his approach. Over his last 107 plate appearances, or 100 plate appearances roughly, his strikeout rate has dropped to 19%. His walk rate has risen to 11%. A 143 WRC plus dating back to mid-August, which is roughly just a month and change. And I mean, that's starting to get real. That's some real stuff. The BABIP over that span, more normalized to 370, yet the average is right around 309. On base percentage at 393. This is for real. I really think this is for real. I don't know if he's going to be a 300 hitter, but I have been really encouraged by what we have seen from Brian De La Cruz. And the fact that his walk rate continues to rise, the strikeout rate continues to drop as he gets more comfortable and continues to just seem like he has more of a plan at the plate. This is getting pretty exciting, I think. And he has earned himself an opening day spot next year, no doubt about it. And the Marlins may even have their answer, potentially. I mean, there's a lot that can change here. At the end of the day, it's still only been, what has it been? Roughly 184 plate appearances. So this is not a huge scale by any means, but a lot of the metrics, a lot of the chase rates, a lot of the batted ball data all point towards this being somewhat sustainable, or at least close to it. And given the Marlins situation in the outfield and a lot of the lack of translation when it comes to prospects, this is a very exciting development. The most encouraging thing, I think, is that he is pulling the ball less than he ever has. He's going to all fields. When he first was called up, he was looking to do damage on the pull side. He's still looking to do damage on the pull side when he's in hitters counts, but that's different now. He's only looking to do that more so in hitters counts. When he is behind in the count, he's just looking to put the ball in play, drive it where it's pitched. The batted ball distribution, he's always been a guy that pulls the ball well above average, even in the minor leagues, even this year in AAA, since he's gotten to the big leagues with the Marlins, 34% pull rate, 39% back up the middle, 26.8% the other way. When he was in AAA this year, he was going pull side 44% of the time. Before that, more like 48, at times even 50% of the time, he was going pull side. Really good stuff all around. The home run to fly ball rate also, that was something I was a little worried about because he has above average raw power. He doesn't have plus raw power, and you go from AAA, where the ball flies in the league that he was in, to the Marlins' home park in Lone Depot, where it is not easy to get it out of there. His home run to fly ball rate in AAA was 14.8%, meaning the percentage of balls you hit in the air that leave the yard. Now, his home run to fly ball rate has only dropped 2.3% to 12.5%. That is incredibly, incredibly encouraging, and maybe one of my favorite figures that we're seeing from him aside from the walk and strikeout rates. This is all good news. I'm not going to say De La Cruz is here and he's the future of this team, but the fact that I can float that and that there is a possibility that that is the case and that I actually can see that being a result here is a huge win, especially given that the Marlins only gave up Yimi Garcia for him and he's 24 years old. At the very worst, he fades a little bit and you still have a really solid depth piece here and a Harold Ramirez type, at least with a better approach and better defense. So while we were upset that the Marlins let Harold Ramirez walk, this is no doubt an upgrade over Harold and younger and, knock on wood, not as much of the recurring injury issues that Harold had and a much better approach, as Harold was pretty allergic to walks. I got to talk about Nick Fortes because, holy crap, where did this guy come from? I know we had talked about him a little bit in the past with what he was doing in points in the minor leagues. He had had some really hot stretches in the minor leagues this year, but then had kind of come back down to earth a little bit, had slowed down a tad in AAA. In AA, he had a great stretch where eventually he got promoted, but still his AA WRC plus was at 98, so about 2% below average. You'll take that from a catcher, though, if that's able to translate through into AAA in the big leagues. AAA 89 WRC plus, but showed some good defense. And again, given what the Marlins have had at that position, you'll take that any day of the week. He comes out now in the major leagues, and in 5 games and 11 plate appearances, he has hit 3 home runs. Just to put context to that, he had 7 home runs in nearly 100 games in the minor leagues this year. He has now 3 home runs in just 5 games. More context, in AA, 57 games, 3 homers. He's matched that in 11 plate appearances so far this year at the big league level. So unsustainable? Yeah, probably. I would say his 900 ISO is unsustainable. His 600 batting average is unsustainable. But this is interesting here. And depending on how his defense is behind the dish, it was a little bit wonky in his first appearance that we saw him back there. There was a couple pass balls. He just didn't look totally comfortable. Might have been one pass ball and a wild pitch, but didn't look totally acclimated, but it wasn't the easiest situation ever to come into. And I do think that he is going to settle in and be a decent defensive catcher. If he continues to develop as a defensive catcher, now we're looking at an intriguing option here. At the very least, a defensive backup would be the profile that he had before. I don't know how the defense looks. I really haven't seen enough of him. But if the offense is half decent, this is a better option than anything the Marlins have had this year. Really, it's just that simple. He's going to be a much better option than anything the Marlins have had. But that being said, they need to go get a legitimate catcher. And I've been talking about Jacob Stallings for like 50 years now, and he has no pass balls the entire season. He's the best catcher in defensive war. He's the best catcher in almost every defensive metric you can look at. And he's been swinging at half decent as well, too. Alex Jackson is a great defender. Massive disappointment at the plate since that trade. And Adam Duvall has been fantastic for the Braves and a big part of what they're doing over there. So pretty frustrating. No doubt about that. Definitely not an ideal situation. I don't mind the Marlins taking a flyer on a guy like Alex Jackson, a former first round pick, a former top 100 prospect with crazy power who was putting up good numbers in AAA. But obviously that flyer has not looked great. And with that being the case, I want to see Nick Fortes get the at-bats the rest of the way. I really do, because it'll help you figure out, I think, if you're the Marlins, what you're going to do this offseason. No matter what, you're getting a catcher. But how are you planning? How aggressive are you going after a catcher? How much do you believe in Nick Fortes? I don't think that you're going to get a full answer in just about a dozen games or so, or a little bit less than that. But it will help to even see him play 10 games down this stretch, see him catch those ball games, see how he handles Sandy Alcantara and his 100-mile-per-hour stuff, see how he handles the at-times erratic Jesus Luzardo. and see how that will fit into next year's plans. And it will help you figure out what the plan is here moving forward with some of your guys, especially the fact that they got Peyton Henry, another catching option back there who could be a backup. I don't know much about his defensive ability either. So there's definitely some stuff to sort out. I would love to just see Fortes get a majority of the at-bats the rest of the way. I don't think Alex Jackson is going to have the ability to make enough contact to be a legitimate starting catcher in this game, and he will have to be a superb, superb defensive catcher to justify keeping him on a big league roster, which is possible. He could be the Jeff Mathis type of defender with more power, and you could maybe help for a Mike Zunino type of outcome if he's that good defensively, but I just don't know if he's that good defensively. We have to see a little bit more. But to talk about Lewin Diaz here to wrap up, because I've loved what we've seen from him and Jesus Sanchez so far this season. These guys have just been swinging it. They really have. And actually, let me start with Jesus Sanchez, because he's been doing it for a little bit longer now. And all of a sudden, he's got a 114 WRC plus. He is starting to settle in with his approach a little bit too. 13 home runs in 57 games. When the guy hits the ball in the air, there's a good chance it's leaving the yard. And that's what's been really exciting about him, is his exit velos. The amount of power that he possesses is ridiculous. It's more so how frequently can he make contact. 30% of the balls he hits in the air have left the yard. That was somewhat close to the figure that he had in AAA. I think that'll normalize a little bit, but similar to like I talk about with Griffin Conine, it's not about really whether they'll be able to hit a lot of home runs when they connect with it, because when they connect, it's going to go. It's really going to go. There's no in between. It's either ridiculously hard contact or no contact. And I think we've seen Jesus Sanchez improve in that regard as well. He's even walking at a respectable rate for his standards, given what he has shown us in the past in that regard, because he has never been a guy that really takes his free passes. He's always had an approach that is uber aggressive, that expands the zone, and not so much the case as much now, where we're seeing him still expand the zone at times. The strikeout rate is still quite high, but he's taking his free passes now more than he ever did before. The walk rate over the month of September, 10%. And I think part of that is that teams are starting to be a bit more cautious with how they pitch Jesus Sanchez. He's one of the guys, when you look at the Marlins lineup right now, you're a little bit nervous that he's the one that might do damage to you. Him and De La Cruz are the guys that are really doing damage, and Lewin Diaz as of late too. So you look at what Jesus Sanchez has been able to do, 7 home runs this month in his last 81 plate appearances. He is also acknowledging that he's going to see some more stuff outside of the zone. And while there's some swing and miss in his game, because at times his swing can get long, at times he'll get tied up a little bit, and I think his path is something that needs to be tweaked a bit in the offseason. That 35% K rate, 34% K rate on the month, not ideal, not egregious. If he can drop it even just to the 30% range, 28 to 30% range, he'll be great. But the fact that he's offsetting it with a 10% walk rate is very solid. The 139 WRC plus, buoyed by the walks, by the 7 home runs. I like what I've seen from the eye test. The takes have been a lot better. There's definitely a lot of encouraging aspects. I see him not chasing as much and more so just getting beat at times by good pitches. And I really do believe he will rectify that as he continues to hone in on that approach. And he'll always be a guy that's going to strike out in the high 20s, maybe even 30%. But if he walks at a 10% clip, the rest, I think, will take care of itself with the power output that he is capable of. So another guy that has earned himself a potential opening day spot next year, and we're going to get to see them play day in and day out. The tough part is the Marlins want to be competitive next year, and not to say that starting De La Cruz and Lewin Diaz and Jesus Sanchez makes them not competitive, but it means that they're going to really have to bolster the other spots, which is catcher and maybe even third base, and definitely the bullpen, because I want to see how these guys do. I think these guys could be a big part of the future, but there's going to be a bit of ups and downs and a little bit of unknown with these players, given that they're young and they're just now putting it together. There's a level of me that's like, okay, go get the veteran out there. But there's the other side of it, which is like, you don't want to block your young prospects or young players who are all of a sudden starting to look really, really good as of late. And that's where you have a tough decision to make. The Marlins said going into this year that they didn't want to block any of their prospects. They clearly didn't do that. But guys like J.J. Bleday never made it up because they didn't hit. And there weren't that many guys to block, point blank period. But to wrap up here with with Lewin Diaz. He has been phenomenal. We talk about the big home run, the walk-off, multi-home run game. Since the start of September, he has kept the K rate at 25%. The only issue I have is that he is almost never walking. 3% walk rate on the month, but the batting average is there at 283, but when you're slashing 283, 309, and then 528 is great. I would like to see him walk a bit more. That's just something that I know has been a trend throughout this entire episode, but when all of these guys are susceptible to swing and miss, you can't walk 4% of the time. I know Diaz has been better in the minor leagues when it comes to walking at least relatively decently, but he's never been somebody that walks even at an average rate until this year in AAA. So that's something to watch, especially as a first baseman. I'd like to see him get on base a bit more. And I wonder how much that is making the Marlins nervous that it may put too much pressure on his bat to ball skills if he's not walking at all, especially as a big power guy at first base. So that is something to watch as we go down the stretch here. But the swing is so pretty. Overall, he looks much more comfortable up there. He's going to all fields a bit more. We're seeing him go the other way. We've seen the prodigious power from him too. I want to see more. I definitely want to see him up there next year. But I do kind of like the idea of keeping one of Cooper or Aguilar to hedge some of that risk of having another rookie in the fold out there with an inconsistent approach at first base in a premium offensive spot. That is definitely a situation there where seems like Cooper makes a lot more sense than Aguilar, because if you have a couple different guys with some risk of Jesus Sanchez and Lewin Diaz or even De La Cruz, De La Cruz is going to be more in center. So you look at Lewin Diaz and Jesus Sanchez, corner outfield and first base, Garrett Cooper could slot into either of those two spots if one of the two guys falters. And that's why it seems like Cooper makes more sense to keep, though Aguilar has been fantastic this year. That might be a guy that you look to deal and see what you can get there and just continue to try to wheel and deal this offseason. And I really think that they can do it. There's definitely enough there. They have more than enough capital, and they have some financial flexibility, or at least it would seem like they should have some financial flexibility depending on what they want to do this offseason. Well, that'll do it for today's episode. I hope you have a great weekend and enjoy the rest of this Marlins season the best way that you can. I look forward to talking Marlins with you next week.